Order, order.
United Future.
One vote in favour.
Jubilation on the opposition benches on Wednesday night as the United Future member for Ohio, Peter Dunn, votes with them in support of Sumaroni's members' bill extending paid parental leave to 26 weeks. The result of that division announced by Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard.
The ayes are 61, the noes are 60. The bill will be read a first time.
Order. Although it's the first reading for that bill, now with the Government Administration Committee till mid-March next year, it's the second time that bill's gone through the House. Its predecessor defeated at the final hurdle by a change of numbers in last September's election, only to be drawn from the ballot again in an incredible stroke of luck, although Sumaroni played her winning ace right at the end.
A Speaker. Point of order, Sumaroni.
Speaker, I seek leave to table a document. It's a letter, an open letter, to the Honourable Peter Dunn, asking him to support the bill that has just been passed. It's in the name of myself and 14,463 other signatories.
There appears to be no objection that the letter can be tabled.
While Sumaroni's members' bill survived by one vote, another up for its first reading on Wednesday night failed by the same margin. From New Zealand First List MP Dennis O'Rourke, it proposed a pro-rata entitlement to New Zealand superannuation based on residence and presence in New Zealand between the ages of 20 and 65 years.
It would not alter the age of eligibility from 65 years, nor its freedom from means testing, nor universal entitlement.
But Dennis O'Rourke's assurances did not deter National's David Bennett from accusing the New Zealand First Party of having a hidden agenda.
They want to say to superannuitants, if you're over 65, whatever contribution you make to this country doesn't matter. That is what the New Zealand First Party is signalling, and it is a disgrace to this Parliament. It is a bigoted party that should not be in this House.
David Bennett's attack brought Labour's Grant Robertson into Dennis O'Rourke's defence.
There is only one disgraceful person in this House tonight, and that is David Bennett. David, Mr. Bennett, that was an appalling contribution. There was nothing in that speech about an incredibly important topic to the future of New Zealand. In this side of the House, Mr. Speaker, in the Labour Party, we might not support every bit of this piece of legislation, but at least Dennis O'Rourke has come to this House to address the issue of how we make superannuation sustainable in this country. And all you've got to offer is insults and nonsense, Mr. Bennett. You are a disgrace.
Grant Robertson and Labour were joined by all other parties except Peter Dunn this time. The opposition's 60 votes insufficient to secure Dennis O'Rourke's bill, a first reading against the 61 of United Future Act and National, including David Bennett, whose attack on the New Zealand First Party included this reference to its leader.
Everybody in that party's over 65, and none of them have contributed anything to this Parliament in the entire time they've been here, especially the leader of that party, Winston Peters, who's gallivanting around the world at this time when it should be here. Oh, where are we going?
A point of order from the New Zealand First Party's Tracy Martin.
I'm sure, Mr. Chair, that you know of the standing order that says you are not allowed to refer to the absence of a member in this Parliament. I ask you to uphold those standing orders, sir.
Actually, there is no standing order. It's just a convention that members do not draw attention to a vacant seat in the chamber or in a committee room. Observed this week more in its breach than its observance. Also keen to draw attention to Mr. Peters' absence was the Prime Minister, although Mr. Key's disregard for the convention was defended by his right-hand man in the chamber, Jerry Brownlee.
The member who is being spoken of is actually considered to be in the precincts of Parliament during this two-week period, while in fact he's in London swanning around as the media agent for the
Order. But the Speaker, David Carter, was not impressed when Health Minister Jonathan Coleman drew attention to the absence of Labour's Dunedin North MP David Clark on Thursday.
It's just a pity Mr. Clark couldn't stay in the House to ask a question on an issue.
Order. Member does not need to go there if he wants to remain to answer a supplementary question.
But the Minister wasn't listening.
And I'd be delighted to brief Mr. David Clark of Dunedin North on this issue, seeing he's missing this very important update here in the House.
Order. I am going to ask the Minister to leave the House. I warned him earlier. He knows full well that it's against standing orders to refer to a member who is not in this House. The Minister's now finished his questions. He can leave the chamber.
His day done, the Minister of Health gathered up his papers and left the chamber, although David Clark, who had chosen to leave rather than withdraw an interjection calling on Jonathan Coleman to tell the truth, changed his mind and, as Rhys Lyon reports, returned later in the afternoon.
In respect, Mr Speaker, of my previous comment in question time, as requested by the Speaker, I withdraw.
David Clark also sought a clarification from the Speaker.
I seek your considered ruling. A quick search of the Hansard has revealed that raising questions about the honesty of members appears to have become more commonplace, and that the exact same entreaty that I used is recorded on more than one previous occasion in the Hansard with no such rebuke from the Speaker.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard had this warning for his Labour colleague.
One has to take particular care on anything which might be a reflection on the Speaker. And alleging inconsistency of that sort is one of the things which is a reflection on the Speaker.
Speaking to the point of order, Mr Mallard informed Mr Clark of the appropriate way forward.
If in fact members are alleging that a minister is deliberately not telling the truth, then the appropriate thing to do is to write a letter to the Speaker and ask for a reference to the Privileges Committee.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard. And the Privileges Committee this week issued its report on the use of social media to report on parliamentary proceedings. But as Labour's Shadow Leader of the House, Chris Hipkins, explained in Wednesday's debate on the report, social media had more uses than just the reporting of Parliament.
I see social media as a fantastic opportunity to actually open up the House to greater public involvement. There is opportunity to involve the public more in having their say on debates in the House through social media. We're using social media more to get select committee feedback, for example, invite submissions, promote submissions, and those sorts of things, and I think those are welcome developments. I also think, some people won't always agree with me, that opening up some of the interchange that we have across the chamber through social media and allowing others to take part in that can also be quite good for the Parliament.
Also speaking in the debate, Attorney General Christopher Finlayson issued a word of caution to MPs.
All members of Parliament should be aware that anything said on social media may not be protected by parliamentary privilege and could be potentially actionable in the court. So if one is sitting in the House merrily tweeting away, it will not necessarily be part of the proceeding of the House, and so the best advice that can be offered is watch it.
Attorney General Christopher Finlayson speaking in the debate on a report from the Privileges Committee on the use of social media to report on parliamentary proceedings, which also removes the ban on televised coverage of the debating chamber being used for satire.
Rhys Lyon, and after their debate on the Privileges Committee's report, MPs used the rest of Wednesday to make progress on their members' bills, creating three vacant slots on their order paper to be filled the next day by bills drawn from the ballot. As for government legislation, the week saw four bills off to the committee rooms on completion of their first reading, three second readings of bills coming back from committees, and one third reading in extended time on Thursday morning. But when the government's leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, tried to repeat the exercise next week to put four government bills through their third reading next Thursday morning, the opposition called for a division. Normally a formality, agreed at the multi-party business committee, extended sittings have been used in the past for making progress on treaty settlement bills and non-controversial measures. But the inclusion of government bills and growing dissatisfaction with Mr Brownlee's management of government business in the chamber surfaced again on Tuesday when Labour's Grant Robertson complained about the government's move to cut a bill's time with a select committee.
The practice of the government of coming to this House with truncated select committee processes is one that we regard with, I guess the best word is suspicion, because frankly it happens too often and it goes against what is good practice in this Parliament. Once again, I think we've got a piece of legislation here that's getting a truncated select committee process, because the government can't manage its own business.
Labour's shadow leader of the House, Grant Robertson, now with what did go down in the committee rooms this week, back again to Rhys Lyon.
Labour MP David Parker was on the other side of the tables on Thursday morning, presenting his members' bill calling for a minimum wage for contractors. Speaking to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee, Mr Parker outlined the problem his bill seeks to address.
The minimum wage only applies to employment relationships and not to contractual relationships. There's a growing class of people who somehow fall in the middle, and there's an argument as to whether they are an employee or a contractor.
Mr Parker also explained what the bill didn't do.
This bill doesn't fix things in respect of holiday pay or sick pay, or create additional rights under employment-like rights for contractors. But what it does say is that contractors ought to be paid a minimum wage as well.
Labour MP David Parker presenting his minimum wage contractor remuneration amendment bill to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee on Thursday. Also in the committee rooms this week, members of the Law and Order Committee were briefed about the New Zealand Public Interest Project, an independent group formed to investigate claims of wrongful imprisonment and miscarriages of justice. Spokesman Jared Gilbert told the committee that one estimate puts the number of innocent people in New Zealand's jails at up to 20.
Now, if we look at that as a number, it doesn't sound particularly high, unless, of course, you're one of the 20. And what that also doesn't perhaps explain is the fact that those 20 move through the system, so it's 20 at any one time. And being in prison is one thing, but living with a stigma, particularly of quite serious, a serious crime that you haven't committed, is no small matter.
Jared Gilbert had two main messages for MPs.
One is to appreciate the importance of the work that the New Zealand Public Interest Project is looking to do. And two, we would be more than grateful if you could make us redundant and establish a Criminal Cases Review Commission, which is properly funded and properly resourced and has legislative authority, because I think the work that we will do will fill a very significant gap in our justice system.
Jared Gilbert briefing the Law and Order Committee about the work of the New Zealand Public Interest Project. In total, there were 12 committee meetings held during the week. Back to the chamber now, where the House sat in extended hours on Thursday morning, technically a continuation of Wednesday's sitting day, when MPs debated four government notices of motion, including the appointment of former Family Court Judge Peter Boshier as Ombudsman, a move announced by Government Minister Joe Goodhue, who sought to explain the role of the Ombudsman's office.
It is an organisation that is able to conduct, free of charge, examinations into all manner of requests from the public that relate to the activities of governance in this country. It is also the organisation that has the greatest influence on the application of the Official Information Act.
Speaking on the appointment, Labour's Trevor Mallard took exception to that last point from Joe Goodhue.
And that is whether it's the Office of the Ombudsman who has the most influence over the workings of the Official Information Act. That's just not correct. It is the leadership of the government which is most important in that. And I think that that's something that would be good for the new Ombudsman both this government and the next government to reflect on.
Mr Mallard did, however, support the appointment of Peter Boshier to the role.
He is currently a Law Commissioner, widely respected in the Pacific, and I'm sure that he is very, very suitable to do this job.
Mr Mallard also thanked Dame Beverly Wakeham.
Not only for the time she spent as Chief Ombudsman, but also for a career of many, many years in the broader state sector. She's made an enormous contribution.
Other appointments debated under extended hours included that of Greg Sholem as Deputy Controller and Auditor General, Diane Mackerskill and Simon Murdoch as members of the Independent Police Conduct Authority, and the reappointment of Dame Linda Holloway as Chair of the Abortion Supervisory Committee, along with the reappointment of Dr. Tangimoana Habib and the appointment of Carolyn McIlraith as members of that committee.
Rhys Lyon, finally, while the Prime Minister John Key and opposition leader Andrew Little volleyed points of order over the table separating them in the chamber, vying not to be seen as the one blocking the addition of a fifth design to the First Flag referendum, the Deputy Leader of New Zealand First, Ron Mark, used Wednesday's general debate to leave no doubt about where his party stood on the issue.
New Zealand First stands firmly, firmly on the side of the nationalism, on the side of this flag, on the connection to the crown, on the monarchy, and we will not deviate from that, not one inch. What we will say to this government is listen up to the people in New Zealand. Listen up to them, because overwhelmingly they don't want this government's referendum. If there should have been any referendum, it should have been, do you want a flag change, yes or no? And the government would have got a resounding no, and we could have moved on and saved millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Enough, maybe, to buy Silver Fern Farms. I'm Tom Fruin, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.